You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 216 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Supersensible Impulses in the Historical Development of Humanity, eight lectures translated by Paul King. This is Lecture 4, given in Dornach on the 23rd of September, 1922. In our considerations of the human being, I spoke yesterday about matters to do with history, insofar as these lead us into the spiritual world. And I looked at two earlier epochs of human development from that perspective. I drew attention to how the more ancient initiates endeavored to guide the people in religious, social, and other matters, by selecting as their helpers those spiritual beings that are connected with human breathing. And we saw how these beings, in turn, are connected in the cosmos with what reveals itself outwardly as moonlight. We can therefore speak about certain moon beings being used as helpers during the period when such things were necessary, namely in the Egyptian period, to give direction to the religious and social life of ancient Egypt, and to other areas besides in that ancient historical development. We then saw the importance of certain beings in Greek culture, which yesterday I called elemental luciferic beings. These were used as helpers by the Greek initiates, for example, those in the Orphic Mysteries, to inaugurate Greek art. I pointed out how even today, if we have a somewhat deeper and more intimate sensitivity for such things, we can see in the traditional sculpture of Homer's head the profound listening of this human individual to what yesterday I called a touching hearing, a hearing touching, and what was essentially a listening to spiritual beings. These were the air beings that used the state of balance between human inhalation and exhalation in order to establish a rhythm between respiration and blood circulation. Through the wonderful ratio that existed in human beings between breath rhythm and pulse rhythm, the Greek hexameter could arise, and indeed all the other Greek meters. These were a creation both of the human being and of the rhythm, so full of mystery, that undulates and vibrates through the entire cosmos. I said that when the Greeks speak of Apollo's lyre, we can think how the strings of this lyre were tuned according to impressions attained from the perception of this combined rhythm. Since that time, humankind has entered upon a completely different development, and I have drawn attention on many occasions to the characteristic features of this development from the most varied points of view. I have drawn attention to the fact that ever since the 15th century, humanity has been in the grip of the intellectual element that dominates all human culture and civilization today in the broadest sense. It arose in modern development because an older language, which in its primary form was connected with what I called that deep listening to rhythm in the Greco-Latin period, because the Latin language continued deep into the Middle Ages and completely intellectualized itself, so that in many respects the educating of modern humanity into modern intellectualism has been brought about by the Latin language. This intellectualism that is based on thoughts completely dependent on the development of the physical body is actually bringing the whole of humanity into the danger of falling away from the spiritual world. And indeed, we can say that if the old religions speak of a more ancient form of fall, seen more as a moral fall, then we must speak of the danger of modern humanity as being that of an intellectual fall. The general thoughts of humanity today, which people regard as having the greatest authority, the so-called clever thoughts of modern science. These intellectual structures are founded entirely on the human physical body. We mustn't believe that when a modern person thinks, he is assisted in this by anything other than the physical body. Thoughts in earlier ages were something completely different. In earlier periods of historical development, thoughts came to people along with certain spiritual visual perceptions. Visual perceptions either pressed through to people from the cosmos, or could also rise up out of their inner being. We could say that thoughts were carried on the waves of these spiritual perceptions. These were thoughts spiritually given, thoughts that were sent to people from the spiritual world, thoughts that revealed themselves to humanity. Intellectualism has no access to thoughts such as these. When we ourselves form our thoughts purely following logic, which is what modern people strive to do, our consciousness is thereby bound to our physical body. It is not that thoughts themselves arise from this physical body. That is naturally not the case at all. But the forces that are active in these thoughts are not in modern people's awareness. They don't get to know thoughts in their true nature. All the thoughts that modern people already receive at school, what they absorb as popular science, what is to be found in popular literature, all these thoughts in their actual substance, in what lives in them, are unknown to the modern person. They know them only as reflections. The physical body is the mirror, and people are not aware of what is actually living in their thoughts. They are aware only of what the physical body reflects back to them of these thoughts. For if people could really live into these thoughts, they would be able to perceive their own pre-earthly existence. They are unable to do this. Modern people cannot perceive pre-earthly existence because they do not live in the substance of their thoughts, only in thought reflections. These thoughts are not realities. And this is what is so dangerous for modern humanity, that in these thoughts there is spirit as very substance. There is pre-earthly life. But people know nothing of this. They only know the reflections. Due to this, something that is actually meant for the spiritual world, for these thoughts are indeed meant for the spiritual world, they are rooted in the spiritual world, falls away from the spiritual world in modern humanity and is reflected by the physical body. And what is reflected there is only the external sense world. So we might really speak of a fall for modern times that is evident in the sphere of intellectualism. The great task of our time, we have often described this, is to bring spirituality, real spirit, into the thought world of people's consciousness. If they wish to live in the modern world, modern people cannot do away with their intellectualism, but they must spiritualize this intellectualism. They must bring spiritual substance into their thoughts once more. Since this is our task, we find ourselves in the opposite position from that of the ancient Egyptian initiates and what they had to do. In pre-Egyptian times, the initiates of Asia, because of the natural clairvoyance in ancient peoples, could use the intermediary states still prevalent in people between sleeping and waking to get the moon beings that were able to live in people's inhalation to be their helpers. But during the Egyptian period, people gradually lost the old clairvoyance, and the initiates were obliged to create a habitation on earth for their helpers because these moon beings had gradually become shelterless on earth, as I described yesterday. And I said that the habitations the Egyptian initiates created for these moon beings were mummified human bodies, were mummies. Mummies therefore, really played the greatest role imaginable during the historical development of the third post-Atlantean epoch. In the mummies, there lived those elemental spirits without which the initiates could barely do anything on earth in the sphere of societal relations among people. Thus, what had been very possible in the conditions of more ancient times, that is, making helpers out of the moon beings that lived in people's inhalation for the spiritual guidance of earthly development, was then effected by way of a substitute, by a surrogate in ancient Egypt, by what was then done by the elemental spirits that had their habitation in mummies. Today we are in the opposite position. The Egyptian initiate looked back to a former time for whose features he had to find a substitute. We must look to a future where there will once again be people who live with the spiritual world, people who carry the impulses of their morality in their individual character, as I have described in my book titled The Philosophy of Freedom. I discuss in the book how moral impulses are born in the individual human being and must work into the world out of the human individual. They will only be able to do this when the exhalation of these individuals is configured in such a way that images or reflections of this morality and moral disposition are imprinted by the exhaled air into external cosmic life. Just as in inhalation, cosmic etheric forces enter the human being and work to maintain our organs, as I described yesterday, so must what takes shape in human beings themselves, what is released as the form of their inner organs by leading an intellectualistic life, imprint itself as impulse in exhalation, must enter the external cosmos in our exhaled air. And one day when this earth has atomized into space, a life must exist that is formed in the cosmic ether, because the moral impulses in people, which as you know must arise more and more through moral intuitions, will have sent out their images through exhaled air into the ether. A new earth, a Jupiter planet, as described in my book titled Occult Science, will then be built up out of the condensed forms that will be breathed out by people in the future. We must therefore look to a future for humanity in which exhalation plays a paramount role, where human beings impart to their exhalation that by which they are to build a future. Here we could take further something said in the Gospels. I have often mentioned the words spoken by Christ, quote, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words shall not pass away," close quote. I have indicated that what is meant by this is that a time will come when what surrounds us physically, including the present world of stars, will no longer exist, but that which emerges spiritually from human souls will take its place, and the future embodiment of the earth, the Jupiter planet, will come about. We might complete these words of Christ by saying, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words shall not pass away," if human beings become so permeated by Christ that they impart to their exhaled breath the moral impulses stimulated in their human souls by these words of Christ, and which will then build the new world from the forms that have arisen from human beings. Now, roughly, since the 4th or 5th Christian century, elemental spiritual beings from other worlds have come into the earthly world. Prior to this, these beings were not here. In contrast to the moon beings who played a big role in ancient India and ancient Persia, and who later took up residence in mummies, and in contrast to the air demons that played a big role in the Greek era, and to whom Homer listened so deeply. In contrast to these, we can call the new beings earth beings. We can call these beings, who will one day be the greatest helpers of individual human beings with regard to their individual moral impulses, who will be helpers in building a new earth planet out of the moral impulses of the human being, we can call these beings earth beings, elemental earth spirits, because they are intimately connected with earthly life. What they are waiting for from earthly life is to be sufficiently stimulated in order to fulfill their activity in the future embodiment of the earth. As I said, these beings entered earthly evolution in the 4th or 5th Christian century. I have also stressed in public lectures and elsewhere that remnants of the old clairvoyance lasted even after the mystery of Golgotha. And there were still external human activities, cultic rituals and the like, by which these beings that had been drawn, to put it rather trivially, into earthly development were able to advance. But the tendency of these beings is to help people become strongly individual when they have a moral idea, to configure their whole organism in such a way that this moral idea in the person can become part of their temperament, part of their character, the way their blood is configured, so that they can draw their moral idea, their whole moral quality, from the configuration of their blood. These elemental earth beings can become significant helpers precisely for the human being entering more and more into individual freedom. But these beings have a great obstacle, indeed an enormous obstacle. If what we say is to be based on real experience of the spiritual world rather than on theories that can never be taken fully seriously, we really cannot do otherwise than to talk of these spiritual beings in the way we speak about people, because they are really on the earth just as human beings are. So we can indeed say that these beings feel particularly misled by that which is human heredity. And where the superstition about heredity is particularly intense, it goes against all the inner moods and tendencies of these beings, who are very passionate. As mentioned, you have to accept this paradox, for we have to speak about these beings in the way we do about people. When Ibsen, for example, presented his play Ghosts, which is positively fixated on the superstitious theory of heredity, these beings simply went wild. If I may express myself somewhat figuratively, I would say Ibsen's disheveled hair, his wild beard, his strange gaze, his twisted mouth, all came from the ruffling up that these beings carried out on Ibsen, because they couldn't bear him. Because in this respect he was such a modern mind that firmly maintained the superstition of heredity. You know that when we succumb to this ghost theory, we think we carry inherited predispositions in our blood from our parents, grandparents, and so on, which we cannot get rid of. That we are the type of person we are only through the inherited disposition we carry in ourselves. What Ibsen brought to the fore in a grotesque poetical form, but with a certain grandeur, is something that pervades the whole of modern science. It really suffers under this superstition of heredity. What must become second nature in the modern person is that he gets away from inherited characteristics, that he doesn't remain stuck to the superstitious belief that everything comes from the blood that flows down to him from his ancestors. He needs to start to exercise his own individuality so that his moral impulses adhere to him as an individual human being in this earthly life. And he can become creative and productive through his own individual moral impulses. These beings serve this purpose and can one day become our helpers. Things for these beings in the modern world are not like they once were for the moon beings, who were shelterless, and therefore had to find housing in mummies. Rather, things for these beings, whom we look upon as the hope for the future of humanity, are such that although they are not shelterless in humanity, they are like lost pilgrims who stray here and there and everywhere find circumstances that are not conducive to them. Wherever they go, they feel repelled, and above all from the heads of academics. They don't want to come anywhere near these heads. On all highways and byways, things are uncomfortable for them, for the belief in the omnipotence of matter is most especially abhorrent to them. The belief in the omnipotence of matter is connected with the intellectualistic fall, with the fact that people want to hang on to thoughts that, fundamentally speaking, are nothing, because they are only reflections, and people are not aware of the real substance of their content at all. Just as the Egyptian initiates had to consider how to accommodate the moon beings that had become shelterless, so we are called upon to make it possible for the beings I have just spoken about to find the whole earth hospitable for them and not inhospitable. The worst thing of all that these beings can encounter is modern machinery or modern mechanisms. Modern machines are like a second earth, but an earth devoid of spirit. There is a spiritual element in minerals, plants, and animals. In machines, there are only reflected thoughts. Modern machinery is something that causes continuous pain to these beings as they wander the earth, so that nowadays people's exhalation during the night occurs predominantly in a completely chaotic way. These beings that should actually find their way to the exhaled air in the carbon dioxide that comes from human beings find the way barred on all sides by what is carried out by the intellectualism in the world. As much as modern people push against it, as much as they want to avoid it, there's only one thing that can counter this: the endeavor to spiritualize what people themselves do in the external world. But people must first be educated to this. It will be difficult for them. A person who is merely intelligent, modern people are very intelligent, actually knows nothing, because intelligence alone can't help one to knowledge. And such people that surround themselves with machines in which reflected thoughts are living are actually in danger of losing themselves more and more, of no longer having themselves in their possession, of no longer knowing anything about themselves. They must first be filled once more with a certain substantiality. What these modern intellectualistic people must attain, and by which they must educate themselves, is inner intellectual morality. I will say what I mean by this shortly. People today are terribly clever, but there is actually not much substance in cleverness. One can hear these terribly clever people saying all sorts of things, and they are extraordinarily proud of what they say. We don't have to go far to find examples. For instance, something very curious is currently playing a role in European literature: an exchange of letters written in Russian between two people, Gershenson and Ivanov. The situation in literary form is that they are two people sharing one and the same room, but they are evidently both so exceedingly clever that when they talk to one another, their thoughts burst against each other, and neither listens to the other, because they always both talk at the same time. Otherwise, I could not imagine why they should write letters to each other, since they are both sitting in the same room, one in one corner and the other in the corner diagonally opposite. So there they are, writing each other letters. There's nothing in these letters, absolutely nothing. They are very long, a huge number of words is expended, but there is nothing in them. What is said there by one of the writers is roughly Yes, we have grown far too clever. We have art, we have religion, and we have science. We've acquired all that. We have grown terribly clever. Yet, when one reads this person's writings, who is so terribly proud of his cleverness, one is astonished at how stupid the person is, even though to modern eyes he is clever. In fact, he is so terribly clever in his opinion that he has reached the point where he no longer knows what to do with his cleverness. He longs for the past when people did not yet have religious ideas, nor science, nor art, and so on, and thus lived in a completely primitive way. And the other person can't accept this. It seems to him that all the hodgepodge of culture that continues to develop must show certain fundamental ideas if it is to amount to anything. In short, both men talk about nothing, about absolutely nothing. But they use many words and are tremendously clever. This is just one example. There are plenty more. One might say that at last intellectualism has reached the point when it can have discussions like this. It is roughly analogous to someone wanting to sow oats in a field and discussing with someone else whether oats should be sown or not. It doesn't occur to anyone nowadays that they should sow something themselves in culture and civilization, but everyone criticizes what happens, what ought not to have happened, and what should happen differently according to their ideas. So now they start their discussion. Should one grow oats? Wheat had been grown there some time previously. Should one grow oats in a field where previously wheat had been grown? Or has the field been depleted by the previous wheat crop? Isn't the idea of growing oats complicated by the fact that people used to live there who knew that wheat had been grown there? Yet, on the other hand, didn't these people seem to others to be very nice people? Shouldn't one take into account that they were very nice people? This is roughly how it goes, because no one realizes that they should get on and sow the oats. For our culture to be of value, so that no one goes back to Adam or longs for the end of the earth, let no one who has something to plant into this culture sit and write letters to his neighbor, as is done in this exchange. It is one of the laziest products of modern intellectual life. It is really symptomatic of the decay in the modern life of thought. We must look at these things clear-sightedly. People who are engaged in life can often do a great deal, but they must do what is appropriate to their particular situation in life. There are naturally countless possibilities at 11:45 on 23rd of September 1922 to do one thing or another. But each person must do what the situation requires of them. This fact must also make its way into people's thinking. We must learn that there are certain thoughts we must not allow ourselves, and certain thoughts we may permit ourselves. Just as elsewhere, there are things we do and things we must refrain from doing, so we need to be clear that we may not allow ourselves every thought. Such a view would change a great deal in life. It would be almost impossible for newspapers to be written in the modern style if this were part of general education, because those who are somewhat firmer with themselves would not permit themselves all the thoughts that are written there. But just as it is necessary in the real world for there to be morality in people's actions, so morality must enter also into people's life of thought. Today one hears everyone saying, "This is my standpoint. This is what I think." Well, perhaps it is not at all necessary for them to think this or to adopt this point of view. But people do not yet moralize in their thinking. This is something they still have to learn. Then there would not be such a desolate stream of pseudo-thoughts flowing onto paper as in this exchange of letters. This is all connected with the fact that intellectualism has led people away from real spirit, from an understanding of what is really spiritual. There is currently a very good example of this I will relate this example before I go on with our subject, which I will continue in the lecture tomorrow. There is a Benedictine monk, Alois Major. This Benedictine Major, M-A-G-E-R, recently published a very good booklet on Wandel in Gottes Gegenwart, walking in the presence of God. But this booklet only demonstrates that the Benedictine order, shortly after its founding by Benedict, was once a great institution. For what flows directly from Benedict's rules for this order is still working in this booklet by the Benedictine monk. One can have a certain respect for this booklet, and at any rate it is reading matter, which compared to much of the shoddy stuff that exists nowadays, could be recommended to many. However, we would have to say that although what has been produced by this Benedictine monk is indeed still the best literature coming from that direction, it is nevertheless literature that is completely outdated. This Major has now found himself wanting to talk about anthroposophy. All sorts of people talk about anthroposophy at the moment from the most varied standpoints. They can't prohibit themselves from doing this, even in their thoughts, because they don't realize they have not the slightest understanding of it. But what Major writes about anthroposophy is actually not among the worst. We need to look at this more closely because it is characteristic of the intellectualism of our times. Major says, "Anthroposophists wish to develop their human cognitive faculties in such a way that they can really perceive the spiritual. Indeed, this is what anthroposophy wishes, and also what it does. But now," Major says, "it would be an exceptionally good thing if people could really attain perception of the spiritual world, but they can't, so he says. It's just not possible." He is even of the view that, in principle, it is not impossible, but that people in general are not able to really reach perception of the spiritual world. And he demonstrates that he is not against this in principle by saying, "There have been two individuals who were really able to develop their human cognitive faculties to the point where they could see into the spiritual world. And these two human individuals, in his view, were Buddha and Plotinus." It's very curious that in the view of a Catholic Benedictine monk, the only two people who could really see into the spiritual world were Buddha and Plotinus. Plotinus, whom the Catholic Church naturally regards as a fantasist and a heretic, and Buddha, who was among those whom in the Middle Ages one had to renounce upon oath. Buddha was among the three greatest beings that had to be renounced. And yet Major says of these two individuals that they were able to develop their souls to the point of seeing into the spiritual world. He even uses a curious comparison, a curious image, reminiscent of the thought habits of modern humanity, and namely of the thought habits of militarism. He compares the spiritual world to a city, and those who wish to approach this spiritual world, he compares to soldiers trying to storm this city of God, this spiritual world. And now he says, "It is as though an army had armed itself to storm the city, but only a pair of the bravest soldiers had managed to climb the battlements, and with that the offensive collapsed." During the World War, we read telegrams again and again about offensives collapsing. And today we read in the arguments of a Benedictine monk how those who recognize the spirit are soldiers trying to storm the city of spiritual life, but that the attack fails, with the exception of the two bold soldiers, Plotinus and Buddha, who once managed it. And so you see that this man is not in a position to admit in any way that it might be possible to get to the spiritual world. His intellectualism prevents him from doing so. It is only surprising that he doesn't attribute any Christian individual with the possibility of getting closer to God with real knowledge. But in this respect, he is honest. Therefore, of course, he would also have to reject something like my title, Philosophy of Freedom, because it wants to assert moral impulses as something that can arise from out of the human individual himself. Such a thing, in his view, is simply not possible. For if human beings were left to themselves, nothing spiritual would come out of them. He therefore says that private and public life must gradually be organized according to the precepts of the Gospels. In other words, without in any way understanding why the Gospels say what they do say, private and public life should simply be organized according to the precepts of the Gospels, which the powers of human cognition cannot understand. It is no wonder that based on present-day intellectualism, a view arises which leads this man to say, "It is my inmost scientific conviction that Steiner's anthroposophy can only be described as a skillful systematizing of hallucinations into a picture of the world as a materialization of the spiritual." One can hardly imagine how curiously grotesque what this man writes is, who is actually honest, who is even a fairly significant individual in the present time. To describe him properly, I even mentioned that he wrote a good booklet very recently. This assessment of anthroposophy is his most recent concoction. Just take this sentence, quote, "It is my inmost scientific conviction that Steiner's anthroposophy can only be described as a skillful systematizing of hallucinations into a picture of the world. The theory of reincarnation also ends up as a materialization of the spiritual." Close quote. Well, I would like to say, quote, "Padre, let us suppose that you take your ideas about God and the Spirit seriously. You must therefore locate the spiritual somewhere when you lift yourself up to the Spirit. But you will not allow that a human being can do this with his powers of cognition. I therefore don't understand why you are a padre and wish to dedicate your whole life to the service of the Spirit. If you wish to speak about the spiritual at all, then it is the spiritual that has brought forth the material world." So if someone attains to a perception of the spiritual, what is this perception like? Someone who sticks solely to a perception of what is material has this material element before them, and what is spiritual then seems to be mere thoughts. But someone who turns to the Spirit lives clearly in the intensity, in the reality of the Spirit. From there, the things we can see with our eyes are just intimations. Close quote. To our padre, this seems to be hallucinations. He therefore calls the whole thing a systematizing of hallucinations. It is understandable that it must appear so to him, because when one speaks about the Spirit, one can't at the same time, from that perspective, speak about a material table which one can see with one's eyes and touch with one's hands. In that situation, it is the Spirit that is only an intimation. Thus it appears to our padre like an hallucination. But let us continue. We must say to him, quote, "Padre, just consider that you serve the Spirit. So you must admit that the Creator of what is material lives in the spiritual. And what then is the world according to your view? The materialization of the spiritual." Close quote. So if he really recognizes the world, what is it he must recognize? The materialization of the Spirit. Quote, "But indeed, Padre, you reproach anthroposophy and reject its worldview as a materialization of the spiritual, whereas you have to believe as a fact of the world that it was formed out of the Spirit through a process of materialization. Anthroposophy seeks to penetrate this. You reproach it most of all because anthroposophy takes seriously what you ought to take seriously and do not. That is why you reproach anthroposophy. According to your view, your God, in whom you believe, must at one time have taken seriously a materialization of the spiritual. Otherwise the world would never have arisen through this creation. Do you really take the belief of your religion seriously when you reproach anthroposophy with trying to understand how the spiritual can be materialized? How it could gradually become matter?" Close quote. Just think what an abyss we are gazing into. when we have a fairly clever individual of the present day, one who has learned very well how to think, who has written a good booklet, and we see how he approaches anthroposophy. Just ponder for a moment what is hidden in an assessment like this, and you will see what sort of blossoms intellectualism has brought forth, even from those who devote themselves to serving the Spirit, and how we must get beyond this intellectualism, in a different way, of course, from how the Egyptian priests got beyond the spiritual obstacle that had emerged in their age. What the historical powers are that intellectualism itself must turn to will be our subject tomorrow. The end of Lecture 4.